It's time for Dig Deep on KAXC and KBXC on air, as well as our podcast. I'm Heidi Holton, and joining me, Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator. He's from Strong Towns, and our liberal commentator, Aaron Brown, from Minnesota Brown and the next Great Northern Radio Show, right around the corner,
right
I must add.
Corner. Yes.
So thanks for being here today, you guys.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So we want to have a three-part discussion. We're also going to have, I want to tease folks a bit, we're going to have a podcast-only edition this time as well. But we want to have conversations here about the environment and the economy and how politics a little bit plays into that as well. And I guess we want to begin it at the beginning. I mean, we live in a natural resource-dense area, and that has been good for our economy to begin with. And I think that's where you want to start it, right? The kind of the legacy of our environment.
I actually think back to, because I have this thing where I actually listen to our podcast. I do.
I only listen to myself.
I go back and I actually listen to them because, you know, while you're doing it, you get different things than when you listen. And I was struck in thinking about getting ready for this one, Aaron describing basically like the post-depression Iron Range as a wasteland, all the trees gone, all this mining, all these tailings all over the place. And it's fascinating because I think we think about like a state of nature as being, you know, the boundary waters today where you have this wilderness preserved, but we're a long ways from a state of nature. When we first started to get environmentally aware, let's say, in a modern sense, it was very late in our development of a country. I think people have always had a certain amount of stewardship and a certain amount of understanding. And a lot of that was just tied into the fact that if you didn't take care of your farmland, you were going to starve. Like you had to rotate your crops. You had to do tilling in a different way. You couldn't have just erosion, get rid of all your topsoil. But our actual, like, rise of what I think we would call environmentalism today goes right along with the rise of our mechanization, our ability to do things at large scale, the industrialization, the impacts of that. We think of environmentalism as a response to, you know, rivers that you could set aflame because of all the chemicals in them. We're a long way from that. But a lot of the stuff we're arguing over today are essentially like nuanced derivations of those early policies. So you're more of the like historian on the range. I don't know if you have a
well, you went back to, you know, maybe 80, 90 years ago just then, and I was going to go back maybe a few thousand.
Well, let's go back a few thousand, because as a planner, there's one map that's always fascinated me. When we went and did the surveying across North America after the Louisiana Purchase, we sent surveyors out to mark section corners. And when they did it, they wrote down the tree they found at every section. So we basically have a 1 mile by 1 mile grid of what you'd call the virgin forest, the native forest that was here before white settlement. And it's dramatically different than what's here today. I mean, dramatically different. Mm-hmm. But this would have been the trees we chopped down.
So Mesabi is an Ojibwe word. It's got origins in the Dakota language, too. Of course, the Dakota were here before the Ojibwe. It translates to giant, or loosely to giant. And I always took that as the Laurentian Divide, that formation. It kind of like when you're in the north and you're looking south, maybe even Brit, and you're looking at the divide and you can see it. It looks like a man, you know, laying on his back. And so that was the giant. And I've actually had that challenged in some discussions I've had just in the last year, doing some further research on the word giant Mesabi and the idea that it's a sleeping giant or a mysterious giant. And the notion that that legend of the giant refers not to the Laurentian Divide, but to the glacier that was retreating from the last ice age, which is when the first people got to this region. And they saw the Mesabi giant as a scary place. It was dangerous. It was cold. It was falling chunks of ice, lots of danger, but enormous, unthinkably huge resources, which is what drew people in. So we have always, we meaning the human race, native people before the white settlers, long before, have always viewed this part of the world as a resource center. And I point out the native perspective because over many thousands of years, they developed a relationship with the land that was different than what we today would look at as the relationship with the land, or at least what, you know, white modern Americans would look at as the resources and how to use them. And, you know, I think when you grow up on the range, in your local history class in elementary school, they tell you about the settlers, and they tell you about the loggers and the timber cruisers and then the miners who came in. And that's certainly an important part of our history. But the perspective difference was the real story there, because the settlers coming in viewed this place all at once, whereas the natives had known this place and its many different nuances for a long time. And so when Europeans, impoverished, disease-ridden, hungry with ambition in a class-based structure, landed all along the east coast of the continent, they saw the most enormous forest full of game and fur, and full of eventually minerals to be mined, and vast fortunes to be made, and that there was so much of it, it would never run out. It would never run out. That was the perspective in the 1600s and the 1700s, and all the way through statehood for Minnesota in the mid-1800s. This was the end of the earth, and nothing but money to be made here. Yeah, they had to push the native people off the land, but that was viewed as just part of the job.
They weren't really making very good use of it anyway.
That's right. That was the thing, is that they weren't using it the way we would use it, and therefore...
Is that your opinion on
this, Chuck?
Okay, you might want to clarify.
I'm going to back him up here. What he means okay, is yes, that's what that was the attitude of the time.
That was the attitude of the time. It was like you look out and you say, well, we're not exactly dislocating them. I mean, look, they're not even using it. It would be as if you were sitting on $1 billion mm-hmm. and you weren't doing anything with it, and there were people starving. You'd say, well, I'm just going to go take that because I've got a better use for it.
And there were two things there. Sometimes that's portrayed as a perspective difference. So the natives didn't view the land as belonging to people. So when white people claimed it, they didn't recognize that as a big issue. But really, the bigger issue was Europeans brought smallpox and 1,000 other diseases with them, and about 90% of the native people on the continent died before white people ever saw them.
It didn't look like there weren't many of them.
One of the reasons they weren't using the land is that most of them had died from disease. So that was another thing you don't learn usually until you go to college, which is like, something I think that's important to the story there. So we saw my settler ancestors saw a land of unlimited resource. And what I think the modern, coming back forward into time, into after the Merritt brothers discovering iron ore on the Mesabi, and after all the logging, you know, like I mentioned in the last episode, where we logged over northern Minnesota twice, and it was just clear cut. And so all of the original trees and where they belonged and where things were is gone. It's just going to be a new growth forest now. After all of that, we realized, especially after those big white pines were gone, we realized that, well, this is not a limitless resource. You know, we are taking all of it away. It's causing erosion. It's causing problems. And mining towns always eventually realize that there's the good ore goes first and the profitable ore goes first, and then you work your way down. And so mining towns tend to have a realization at some point that it might be too late to do anything else, and they're running out of ore. And so right around the early 1900s, Teddy Roosevelt famously gets a lot of credit for being the first president to really put conservation as a concept on the map. What he was doing was really just setting aside some lands, some natural places. And, you know, he was still for cutting trees and mining stuff, believe me, but he had this conservation mindset. But by then, you know, a lot of what not the settlers so much as the voyageurs and the first timber cruisers and explorers in this region saw, and what the native people would have known as their home in North America, that world was gone forever at that point. You know, there are parts of that world that remain today, but the vast majority of it on the prairie, in the forest, are different now. And so we live in this kind of new world on top of the old world, and we're trying to figure out, you know, as a genesis, as a people, how do we continue to live and thrive in this place, knowing that the resources are now limited and that we can't use the same tactics that people 3-4 generations used without great consequence?
We're listening to Dig Deep. That's Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. Chuck Marone's our conservative commentator. He continues the conversation and the history of how the environment built the economy of northern Minnesota and the United States.
There's a book called Sapiens, and I can't remember the guy, I can't remember his name. I'm going to do it injustice. It's a fantastic book. It's not a light read. It's a huge, thick commitment. But he talks about the genesis of Homo sapiens as a species and how essentially we have transformed even before, you know, the age where we look out and say, this is nature and nature is trees and nature is deer and nature is the occasional moose and the wolf. That is indistinguishable from what nature would have been 100,000 years ago. And even the native, you know, what we call the Native Americans, the people who were here before white settlement, they had themselves transformed this continent in many, many ways. Their footprint was lighter in some cases. In some cases, it was heavier. You can read Jared Diamond's Collapse and see many, many situations of overbuild of those civilizations as well before Columbus, before European settlement. Nonetheless, in this part of the world, you had a lighter footprint than you did in easier to habit, you know, places that were easier for humans to live. Because it was not an easy place for people to live, you have these really long winters, you didn't have the population density, you had to, you know, grow your food in the summer, you had to, you know, live a lot of the ways that we do, and it was just a smaller population with a lighter imprint. Now, we live here year-round. We need water year-round. We produce sewage year-round. We produce waste year-round. We burn fuel year-round. You know, we mine year-round. These are, you know, just existential ongoing impacts that, now call for a different set of solutions. And I think, you know, the interesting thing, the thing that I want to get into is how we started to become awakened to some of those impacts and then struggled to deal with them and how we ultimately, you know, did. And I think in ways that maybe made sense at the time, but have become ineffective. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, these were monumental legislation that took really decades of struggle to get to and are now, you know, driving our reaction to all of these things. I don't know as they're necessarily up to the task. I don't know if they're necessarily, you know, the best way to approach it, but that was our solution to these existential problems created by the mechanization and the large footprint year-round that we now have.
One of the fascinating things I like to think about, there was a show on cable, I forget what it was, but it would presume all humans immediately disappeared from the face of the earth, and it would kind of look at what would happen to different parts of the world as nature took over, and how nature would reclaim a city, how nature would reclaim paved areas and things like that. And I often wonder what will happen on my native Iron Range if we were to leave things the way they are. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to talk about in this episode was the idea of an environmental legacy. And because when this area was being settled and when the cities and places we now know were being founded, not that long ago, 120, 140 maybe years ago for some of the towns in our area. And when those were being founded, it was a very forward-looking people. There was no past. Past was what they were running from. The future was what counted. And so it was develop, it was build, it was get the minerals. Now we're in this point in our development as communities, as people, where we're looking both forward and back. And we're looking at the way things were, comparing it to the way things are now, and we're imagining what it might be in the future. But I don't know that we're doing a very good job of imagining the future, because there are two things that happen with the past. This is human nature, we tend to remember what was good about it, and we tend to forget what was bad about it. That's true in a family as much as it is in a community, or in a state, or in a nation. And when we look back...
We nostalgize.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know just from my family, talking to them about, for instance, mining or some of these issues that are in the headlines with regard to environmental regulation, they say, well, there wouldn't even be an Iron Range if you had to go through that permitting process. You know, they did all kinds of things. They were pouring all kinds of stuff in there, and all the water was terrible, and basically saying that that's what made us who we are today. But, you know, they like the ease of being able to develop and do things. That's what they remember. But... there were some really terrible consequences that required a lot of mitigation to fix, and that nobody here really wants. You know, nobody really wants lakes you can't swim in.
There was not a trade-off to make at the time.
Yeah.
And now, in many ways, there mm-hmm. is a trade-off.
Right. And so now we're in the business of balancing. We've matured. It's kind of like when you're growing up, you can throw a fit for some candy and then run around in a field all day, and that's your day. But when you're an adult, you have to pay the mortgage bills and then figure out what to do with mom. You know, she might need to go in a home, and all these grown-up problems, right? Well, that's kind of where we are now, is we're realizing there are some grown-up problems with how we've used this resource-laden area where we live. And this is kind of the maturation process that I think is causing a lot of challenge, a lot of difficulty, because some people would, just like when you're growing up, some of your friends want to stay in the past, and some of your friends are quick to move on, and you wish maybe they would look back a little more, or whatever the case may be. We're progressing differently, and I think this is the big challenge for us meaning people who live in northern Minnesota, in figuring out how to go forward with these big issues.
I just want to add one point to that, kind of as a closeout to this segment, because we're going to talk about, I think, some difficult issues here. Oftentimes our environmental issues are framed as, do you want nature or do you want, you know, like human destruction? And I think it's important to note that we start from a spot right now today where we just have human destruction. Like, that's all there is. What we point to as nature is not nature. Deer did not used to roam this mm-hmm. land. Like, we didn't have deer. We had moose,
elk,
and if you went back even further, we had, I don't know, something else, but we didn't have deer. When we look out our windows,
Triceratops.
Yeah, triceratops. We had, I was thinking like woolly mammoth.
Oh, okay. You know, we did have those.
Yeah. But you know, you look out your window and you see the deer and the bunnies and the chickadee, and you're like, I want nature. And you're looking at something that is not actually nature in the sense that we're labeling it that. We're talking about a much altered state. And I think the question is not, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, do we have 1 or do we have 10? On a scale of 1 to 10, we're at 9 or 9.5 or 9.8. And I think if we understand that, it changes the way we look at some of these things, both in a way that I think would challenge a left of center narrative and a right of center narrative.
One of the heady questions I always have with this issue is, if a cancer cell knew it was a cancer cell, what would it do? Would it destroy itself, reform itself, or just carry on the way it is because that's how it is? And I think human development, if you look at how cities grow, how areas are developed by humans, how they were developed and continue to be developed, it's easy to look and say, boy, a town becomes a city, becomes a city surrounded by suburbs. It looks like a cancer cell on the map. It grows, it takes over useful farmland, things like that. And we do this and we wonder, you know, well, geez, where's all the farmland going? What's happening to rural America? But we're watching it happen and humans are doing it. So what are we going to do about that? Now, there are some who would say it's impossible to change that dynamic. But I think the responsible way forward is to think about how we can change maybe our attitude about development. And that might be the only thing we can do in terms of reining in what happens to the environment.
That's Aaron Brown. This is Dig Deep. He's our liberal commentator. Chuck Marone is our conservative. And we will continue this conversation in our next segment.
You've come to the end of the line. You thought I'd be left brokenhearted. You thought you could leave me way behind. Well, I've had enough. You can pack up your stuff. Get off, it's the end.